In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted.
Even Hitler. You know, they find out, you know, Bush has been selling weapons to Iraq since whenever, and we knew that. I knew that during the Persian Gulf War. Those intelligence reports would come in. Iraq, incredible weapons. Incredible weapons. How do y'all know that? Well, we looked at the receipt. But as soon as that check clears, we're going in. What time is the bank open? 8? We're going in at 9. For God and country, and he's a Hitler, and hey, look, a fetus. So whatever you need, let's go. Whatever you, the apathetic, docile masses, need to get behind. Here, here's a fetus. Come on. Here's a little fetus. Look. It's a little fetus. I hate this man on his shirt. He's a hit. He's holding a little fetus.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Chaos Report. I'm Scott Horton. It's 92.7, 95.9 here in Austin, Texas, on the FM dial, KAOS959.com, streaming worldwide on the Internet. My co-host, Sean McKay, will be joining us in the second hour. But first, we have special guest Eugene Jarecki, the director-producer of the new documentary film Why We Fight, which won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival last year and is due to open nationwide February the 10th. Welcome to the show, Eugene.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're also the guy who made The Trials of Henry Kissinger with Christopher Hitchens, right?
I made it with Alex Gibney, who's the maker of Enron, but Hitchens was one of the people in the film, yeah.
Oh, I see. I wonder how close you were to Hitchens or how close you are now that he's such an influential member of the war party.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think Hitchens is a complicated figure. He's a contrarian, so you never quite know where he's going to be, and In the particular time that we were making the film about Henry Kissinger, he was looking to investigate Kissinger for many of the same reasons that Seymour Hersh and a couple of other journalists and ourselves were doing the same.
Right, and now he's on board with the entire program as long as the enemy is somebody Muslim.
You know what I think it is? I think he's got a more complicated platform. I think what happened to Hitchens is that he got bummed out, and he is a very, you know, he's a pretty... when he decides something, he decides it pretty forcefully. And he got bummed out at the way he perceived the American left was dealing with the question of Saddam Hussein. So that, for example, I think he overreacted. But the way he looked at the situation, he would look at the efforts to vilify George Bush by the left and the way in which the left would, to do that, they would pretend that Saddam Hussein was a great guy. And he couldn't take that. He just thought it was too much moral relativism and he wanted it understood. And I think, remember that Hitchens and a number of other journalists kind of, you know, they kind of got their teeth going with the Balkan War, and they sort of learned the lesson that they thought they wanted to implement about humanitarian intervention and that when it's time to do it. And I think they just chose the wrong time. They chose the wrong time and place in Iraq.
Right. Well, and, you know, and the only argument that you're up against is an argument that somehow makes Saddam Hussein a nice guy. It's not too hard to win that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in his position, he decided to go up against this trend of people turning a blind eye to Saddam Hussein, but in order to do that, he ended up putting his muscle behind a war that we now know to have been misbegotten and based on a tissue of lies.
So. Sure. Well, let's not waste this interview talking about stupid Christopher Hitchens. I'm interested whether this thing is going to be playing in Austin. I tried to search around at all the art house cinemas and stuff, and I didn't see anything about it. Do you know?
Oh, yes, I'm sure it will be. I have no doubt about that.
Okay, and now, also, I went to Amazon.com, and on the Google cache, I could find where you could buy the DVD, but if I clicked on the actual link itself, it took me to the Frank Capra propaganda flicks from the 1950s.
I know, which was pretty weird. Well, first of all, last week, somebody was bootlegging the movie, which was I was kind of flattered by. If your movies get bootlegged, it's usually a good sign, but then after, I think, a day or two, of the bootlegger being on there, I think apparently the Amazon took it off, so now they're back to the old original Frank Capra films, and I think it'll be a few months before ours is on there about Frank Capra.
That's funny, and obviously that's where you got the title from your film, right? Why We Fight.
And, absolutely.
And there's some double meaning there. On one hand, the movie obviously is about the military-industrial complex and all the different motivating factors for American imperialism. But on the other hand, you're also talking about yourself, right? And why we fight against militarism and empire.
Absolutely. And I think that Frank Capra himself was using that title in a similar way. Capra had been always a great defender of democracy and of the little guy in our struggle against big forces in our society. If you look at George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, he's trying to stop his little town of Bedford Falls from essentially being taken over by Walmart. And in general, Capra's films always present that struggle between the little guy and the big forces. And in the Why We Fight films, he took that concern for democracy global. And he wanted to tell Americans how important it was that they stand up and fight to defend democracy when it was in peril. And I'm doing the same thing. I see democracy, as many of us do, in peril here at home. And I think it's whenever democracy is in peril, whether it's from without or within, it's the duty of all of us to stand up and fight for it, and that's what my film is about.
Well, would Capra not be making movies for the neocons today, saying we're fighting for democracy in Iraq?
No, because I think unlike the neocons, Capra had an extreme respect for democracy, and the neocons demonstrated a number of things during the most recent war. One of them was that by not being open with the public and by pursuing a policy that was kept secret from the public, they demonstrated their disregard for democracy, and I think that the memory of Frank Capra should not be confused with that kind of disregard for democracy. He was an art defender and steward of democracy.
Hmm. Which, I hate to just skip right to the end, but since you really brought up the point, I wonder about the whole idea of democracy as an end in itself. It seems like you could basically take your same argument almost and put it in Richard Perle's mouth, and he'd just add a little militarism to it. But I think the question is worth asking, what's so great about democracy anyway? It's democracy that put these Republicans in power and gave them carte blanche. It's democracy that when Bush got on his megaphone on top of a fire truck and said, right, I'm going to send the military to go kill people, his approval rating went to 90-something percent.
Right, but I don't see any of that as democracy. I see that as a number of things threatening democracy. When Bush stood on that tower of rubble and made those comments, he was not telling the American public what was really being discussed behind closed doors. That's not democracy. When Richard Perle talks about dropping bombs on another country to bring democracy, and in the process he's afraid to tell the public what's actually being talked about and what's really the motivating factors, that's not democracy. When an election happens in which so few of the public actually vote, in which people feel disenfranchised from voting, and in which the options they're given come from a very elite set in this country who do not represent the everyday people of this country, and that's all we have to choose from, that too is an unhealthy democracy. And so, no, democracy would look very, very different than the world we're now seeing. What we're seeing is what Eisenhower warned us about. We're seeing a democracy in peril because of forces he was afraid of.
Right, and we started the show with the clip from the Eisenhower's farewell address where he coined the phrase the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
And that really is the center of this documentary. And I should make it clear to people, this is not a Michael Moore kind of just sort of left-wing attack against Bush. It's really not even about Bush at all. It's about
right.
How ever since World War II, America has really created a global empire unparalleled in human history.
Yes, and it doesn't matter what party's in office. I mean, Americans, one of the myths we have is that Republicans own the copyright on war. They don't. If you look at the wars of the 20th century, a disproportionate number of them, in fact, were run by Democrats. And these are the same Democrats who disappointed their voters by not stopping the war in Iraq. And so what we're seeing is a force, war, militarism, that does not care who's in office. It doesn't care what party. It knows that its impulse to go to war will be regarded no matter who's sitting in that Oval Office. And so at the end of the day, I tried to make a film that is nonpartisan, is multipartisan. It looks across the American landscape and tries to bring us together on this question of why we fight, what it's all about, rather than separate us as the media likes to do and as the parties like to do when election time comes.
And, of course, we can go back before Eisenhower and him coining that phrase and just look at our own founding fathers who rebelled from an empire and who
Absolutely.
Went to extraordinary lengths to prevent this country from having a permanent military establishment.
Yes, and it was George Washington himself who warned that standing armies, which were part of what empires need, are the enemy of Republican liberties. And what I hope people understand is that the film, most of all, is about how we went from being a little republic in the Western Hemisphere to being a giant empire is strive to glow. I mean, people don't like to hear that word, but I would ask them, if there's a better word for what we are in the world right now than empire, please tell me. I haven't heard it. And until then, I'm going to say that we've got to look at the empires of the past, the Roman, the British, and others, and look at how they rose and how they fell, because after all, the whole point is to learn from history and to see what the stories of the past are and what they tell us about where we are. And I think Americans want to think of this country as a republic. They want to think that our ideals are alive and well, and therefore we all have a stake in it when the very things we care most about are under siege.
Well, and you know, when you go back and look, it's really because Eisenhower refused to listen to George Washington that he had to give this farewell address. And, I mean, after all, it could have been his first inaugural, right?
That's an interesting point, and it is true that Eisenhower early on, right after World War II, was a big advocate of military industrialization. He saw that one of the, you know, really strategic advantages we had in World War II was our military industrial sector. And so he's recommending that. But what he learns over 13 or 14 short years, sitting in the Oval Office, front row seat at the policymaking table, is that we've unleashed a monster, and that monster was starting to pressure even him as president. He says at one point in the Oval Office, God help this country, when somebody sits at this desk who doesn't know as much about the military as I do.
Right.
The chilling thought, and if you see where we are today, where there's such an extraordinary presence of special interests in Washington, weighing in on policymaking, I dare say Eisenhower's warning has come true.
And, you know, also, it's interesting, I Googled around a little bit. I'm trying to remember, actually, maybe this was in a movie. The original phrase was supposed to be the military-industrial-congressional complex.
Yeah.
But I guess Eisenhower took that out because he didn't want to make it sound like he was promoting an imperial presidency over the prerogative of the Congress. He didn't want it to be misconstrued that way. So he left that out. But the point is still taken that it's these guys who build the weapons who pay for the political campaigns of our representatives in Congress.
Yes, and that's exactly, it's not just paying for their campaigns, it's also bringing jobs to their districts, and that's the most technologically, or I would say technically, efficient way that the military-industrial complex affects our Congress. There's something called political engineering. Look at it this way, if you and I were going to build a weapon, you would think, let's build it all under one roof to take advantage of economies of scale. Well, that's not how the weapons business looks at it. They politically engineer. What that means is they take a weapon like the B-2 bomber, for example, and a piece of it is made in every single U.S. state. A piece of the weapon is made in every single state so that everyone is getting a piece of the action, so that when those congressional representatives come to Congress and that weapon system is being questioned, you know, is it still a viable weapon, for example, for the war on terror since it was invented during the Cold War? And it's under attack, everybody's protecting it because it means jobs for all of them. It means prosperity in their home district. So it's a form of legalized bribery that's buying the silence of the Congress people when that weapon system comes up for review.
Right, and it's only very rarely, like with Duke Cunningham, that you actually see a congressman prosecuted for this kind of thing. It's just the way business is done in D.C.
Yes, because the town itself is being corrupted by these forces, and that's what Eisenhower was so very afraid of.
And it's great, you even focus in the documentary that you made, Why We Fight, you actually show the nice ladies at the bomb factory. And it's my job to make these bombs. And, you know, sometimes I see on the news somebody got blown up, and I wonder whether that was one of the bombs I made. Oh, well, back to work I go.
Yeah, no, I mean, but that's just, you know, and I'm not, when that's on there, that's not making fun of those people. That's just America at a time of conflict, and it's Americans with very few jobs out there, because one of the things, other than in the arms business, and that's one of the things that Eisenhower was afraid of, was the risk that we could become a garrison state. You know, the military-industrial complex is not a conspiracy theory. It's an idea that Eisenhower figured out about how a society can change, how things can shift, so that suddenly a society is sort of tilted toward militarism, where you take so many resources away from vital parts of your national life, like education, healthcare, infrastructure, and you divert those resources completely into your military instrument, before long you end up with a society that is tilted toward thinking that every problem has a military solution. And in fact, sometimes it does, because you've given the military all the money, and there is no money to save the people in New Orleans in infrastructure. You've got to get the guard in there. There is no money for our schools. So a young kid like the kid in my film, he's pursuing education by joining up with the Army. You know, this is a thing where society starts really losing its way, and you end up with a society driven by the most simplistic expression of national security, which is just the military. And that, in fact, in Eisenhower's eyes, is no security at all.
Right, and in terms of the segment, the tremendous proportion, I don't know if you know the numbers in terms of dollars, but there's a tremendous segment of the private economy that is dominated by the creation of new technology. I know a nice young lady who wanted to pursue a career in hard sciences and basically was frustrated by the fact that you can't get a job being a hard scientist unless you're working either for the state making weapons, or for a company that works for the state making weapons. They've basically
right. And Eisenhower has a part of his farewell address. It's not in the film, but people should look it up online, and they can see it on our website. There's a remarkable part of the farewell address where he warns that public policy itself could become the captive of what he called a scientific technological elite, and that's exactly what he means. Is that disc of big science funded by big corporations and the government. And in that, he says, the power of money is ever-present and is gravely to be regarded. It's a very chilling quote where he predicted the way in which all the jobs, particularly in science and engineering, would end up becoming overshadowed by these extraordinarily powerful interest groups.
And we see that when we have specialized weaponry and technology in the hands of the state, like we have in the United States right now with hydrogen bombs and Apache helicopters and all the various weapons in between, basically the only thing we have protecting us from them at this point is the old rule of law that was written back when the average guy had a musket just like the Army did. We have our Bill of Rights from 1789. If they were to rewrite it today, it wouldn't be quite so kind, I don't think.
That's right.
Because they wouldn't have a reason. They're not scared of us. They don't have a reason to be scared of us like the government, like Alexander Hamilton did.
I think it's a different. I think we're living in a very different condition now.
And we also see how the more enemies we make, the more excuses the state has for expanding itself and destroying that very rule of law. As we see with the National Security Agency tapping our phones, and George Bush saying he's proud of it and he's not going to stop.
Right, and that's one of the things Eisenhower warned about when he talked about the risk of destroying from within that which you are trying to protect from without. That you can go so far in trying to pursue security that you can erode the very thing you're trying to protect. This is also what Ben Franklin meant when he said that any people who will trade liberty for security deserve neither. If you are trying to fight a war to protect a democracy, a republic, and you act in anti-democratic and anti-republican ways to do so, then you've lost the war before you've started.
And that's funny because you talk in your movie about the Wolfowitz Doctrine, how in 1991, after the Gulf War, Cheney assigned Wolfowitz, Libby, and Khalilzad to draw up this basically blueprint for American domination of the world, and including in that preemption against anyone who seems like they may ever become a near-peer competitor. And now these guys are the ones obviously in charge since 2001, and we see how, just as you say, it's all counterproductive. As we go around making sure that there are no near-peer competitors to us on the world stage, we end up just pushing China and Russia and Germany and Iran and all our potential adversaries, we end up pushing them into a power block because they see it as their only option to counter our power.
Yes, and I think one of the things we're seeing in this rise of what you're referring to, the neoconservatives or the think tanks, is something Eisenhower also predicted when he talked about the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power that could come from building a military-industrial complex. What he's saying is, if you tilt the society toward militarism, you start to have experts in the woodwork, people who are misplaced power in the wrong hands. You know, who was Scooter Libby 6 years ago? But all of a sudden, I wake up one morning to find out he's been heavily influencing the policies of my country, and I don't remember electing him. I don't even know who he is. And we have a lot of these people operating in the shadows of Washington, the rise of what's known as think tanks, who are affecting policy from unelected positions. That is exactly what Eisenhower was concerned of when he warned about the disastrous rise of misplaced power. And if you see the consequences of the war in Iraq, I think that the word disastrous is applicable.
And you know, at the time that Eisenhower was saying that, it seems to me he wasn't really taking on the mainstream American establishment as it was then. He was, I might even go so far as to say he was sort of voicing the Eastern establishment's concern about the rise of this new Western establishment, raised up on all this government money, in making all these weapons. And it seems now, like we see the way that they kicked Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft out of the government and that kind of thing, that basically the military-industrial complex, in alliance with the neoconservative intellectuals, have basically supplanted the old establishment, which I suppose explains why the bitter infighting between the CIA and the Pentagon in the lead-up to war with Iraq and that kind of thing.
Well, I think what you see is a very neat dovetailing between the interests of the military-industrial complex and the interests of this group of think tank elites. And it's an interesting way that they fit. Think of it this way. One of the things we noticed about a lot of the thinkers who had an influence on this war is that none of them have ever heard a shot fired in anger. None of them are actually military people. So they actually feel very uncomfortable talking to real military people about war. And so they needed a kind of war that they could talk about, that they could be more expert in than the guys who were used to boots on the ground and mud and blood and all of that. Well, along comes the military-industrial complex, who's gaining new ground and making new money by printing very, very shiny brochures and pamphlets and promotional videos talking about this new kind of war that could be essentially run by armchair generals in Washington. It's a push-button kind of war that's so surgical that you don't even need large numbers of troops. You don't need any of that. So all of a sudden, that new economic interest merged perfectly with the interest of these thinkers to feel like they belong, to feel like they have a reason for saying what they're saying. And it gave them a kind of authority and let them run with the ball, and we see the direction that they've run in.
And we've seen, as Chalmers Johnson, the author of Sorrows of Empire and Blowback, says in your movie, we've seen the Defense Department basically completely take over for the State Department when it comes to foreign diplomacy. Generals are doing the negotiating now.
That's exactly right, and that's a shift in emphasis that happened after World War II, where what used to be ambassadors and diplomats in the field, who were our experts around the world, all those people had become replaced during World War II with commanders in the field, and that never went back. And because that never went back, we founded something in 1947 called the National Security State. And the birth of the National Security State reflected that new emphasis on military expertise over diplomatic expertise. Today, of all the money spent in the United States on foreign affairs, 93% is spent through the Defense Department and 7% through the State Department. That gives you a picture of just how much we think about defense and just how much we think about diplomacy in conducting world affairs.
And, you know, for those who think that perhaps this American global empire is really a new thing, because before it was only a defensive posture against the Soviet communists, people like Chalmers Johnson, who was for the Cold War the whole time, many people have recanted that view and now understand that the Soviet Union was never a threat. That really, if anything, the Soviet Union was on the defensive against our aggressive empire, just like the left-wing radicals said. They just happened to be right, that it was really two-thirds of the world for us, one-third for them, and we were the one on the offensive.
I take a sort of middling view of that one, because I think one of the problems you run into is people who experienced Soviet communism and Stalinist aggression and all of that understand that there was some brutal stuff happening overseas. And that what we have, fortunately, is these things become so politicized that everybody becomes an extremist. And I try to avoid that. My own perception of this is that there's no question that we faced a threat from the Soviet Union, and there's also no question that there were actors within the United States who were inflating that threat for political ends at times. Eisenhower himself was a victim of something called the missile gap, which was an idea generated by the military-industrial sector and carried very proudly by incoming President Kennedy to embarrass Eisenhower with the idea that he'd fallen behind the Soviets in missile development. Well, Eisenhower knew no such thing was true. He knew that we were ahead of the Soviets in missile development, but the only reason he knew that was that he was flying secret U-2 spy missions over the Soviet Union, and he couldn't reveal that. So he had to stand by idly and let the Kennedy incoming candidacy make fun of him and his Vice President Richard Nixon for being soft on the Soviets when he knew that they weren't. That's exactly the kind of threat inflation that is voiced by extremists, Kennedy included, at a time where it's politically expedient to do so. And so instead of looking back and saying the Soviet Union wasn't a threat, it's much more correct to say, of course, you've got major powers with nuclear warheads trained on each other. There's a lot of threat going on. But there's also a lot of reason for sanity. And Eisenhower was withstanding those who were elevating the threats and inflating the threats for political ends.
Sure, and I mean the real question is not whether Stalin was a nice guy or not, but whether the Soviet Union was even capable, much less intent on expansion. I mean,
Even that, the trouble with that historically is, I just don't go down that road because I don't think it's a way to find common ground with people who disagree. I look for common ground because my reality in this is, look, the United States is a big country in a big and complicated world. And other countries have their interests, other countries do some cutthroat stuff, and other countries will have it out for you if you are if you don't watch carefully. At the same time, I adhere to Eisenhower's principles about national defense. Eisenhower understood, and nobody had to teach him anything about national defense. He understood that a country's national defense is about more than just bombs. That if you have an uneducated country, because you don't spend any money on education, then who is going to run the machines of war? If you have an unhealthy country without adequate health care, who is going to be fit for war? If you have failing infrastructure, as the streets of New Orleans revealed, then who is going to believe in the country as serving its people enough that they will fight the wars for that country? And by the way, a morning like the morning of Katrina gives our enemies comfort because they see how unprepared we are for emergency. And so Eisenhower saw all of that not only as a moral and ethical problem, but as a national security problem, and he would go face-to-face with anyone in understanding that our national defense needs to have a broader definition. He built our highways out of national defense money, understanding that they were crucial for national defense.
This is the Chaos Report. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eugene Jarecki. He's the director and producer of the new documentary. It's coming out in 11 days called Why We Fight. And this is a great documentary. It features Karen Kotowski, father of a 9/11 victim named Wilton Sexer, Chalmers Johnson, of course, who the listeners hopefully are familiar with, the author of Blowback and Sorrows of Empire, Joe Cirincione from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Gore Vidal, Charles Lewis, who I've interviewed before, from the Center for Public Integrity, Richard Pearl, John McCain, and Bill Kristol, from the War Party, all have parts in it, and even interviews with Ike Eisenhower's son and granddaughter, pilots of F-17 bombers who dropped bombs on Iraq, retired DOD analyst named Frank Spinney, Dan Rather makes an appearance in it, James Roach, the Secretary of the Air Force. It's an incredible bit, and of course, my friend Karen Kotowski is featured throughout it and gets the very last word at the end, which really did it for me. One thing that I saw you talk about on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart was the second answer. I read, I think on your website, that out of 150 people, 120, when asked the question, why do we fight, said freedom.
Yep.
But then you said something to Jon Stewart about the second answer.
Sure. Well, I would ask people, you know, that didn't seem adequate. So I would say to people, well, what do you mean by freedom? And right away you would see their doubts. Right away you would see that people are trying to reconcile their desire to believe that we're fighting for freedom with the reality they see coming out of Washington. People know that something isn't right. They know that they were lied to. They know that there are reasons being discussed behind closed doors that are not being shared with them. And that makes it much harder for them to look you in the eye and give you the answer, freedom. They still do it because we all grew up that way. We all did the Pledge of Allegiance. We all are used to saying freedom, and we should be. It's a beautiful thing to feel and think. But the trouble is people are increasingly feeling like it's hard for them to reach and touch it. And that's what we sense when we talk to people. We could see those doubts accumulating in their minds, and we could see that it was hard for them to repress those doubts.
Yeah, well, and it's a beautiful thing to just stop repressing it and go ahead and admit to yourself that, you know, that slogan I just chanted at you isn't really accurate.
And you could see that people felt relieved to be able to talk about those things. And it wasn't, they were, you know, these are people who love America. Sometimes we were talking to people at 4th of July celebrations, and they were dressed in the red, white, and blue. And, of course, on a day like that, they're going to say freedom. And it's a sunny day, and you feel great to be alive and great to be alive in this country. And the trouble is that when they go home and turn on the TV, they're reminded that there are things at work that are not what they expected, and they're not consistent with their ideals. And they're trying very hard to reconcile with those things. And people feel overworked and overburdened, and every time they pick up their head to look, they're getting another piece of corrupt news out of Washington, and that erodes national morale, and it's why we see the divided country we see today.
Right. It's not really, as you told the Village Voice, actually, it's not the apathy of the American people, really. It's the helplessness. We know that we don't have any power, so why bother, really?
And I don't agree that we don't have any power. I think I would say we think we don't have any power. we do have power. We had power when there was a public outcry over the streets of New Orleans, and it caused this presidency to have to backpedal. We have had power throughout human history when we moved the needle of this society to make women's voting possible, to make black rights possible, to give minorities rights that they didn't have before. Human history is a long story of dark chapters like we are in right now, and your listeners should not forget that in those dark periods, people have gotten frustrated, and they have sought answers, and they have gotten louder and louder until their voices could not be ignored, and they never could give up. So it's not that we are helpless, it's just that sometimes you can feel that way, but I think people are waking up and people feel less and less helpless every day.
You asked the question, why do we fight to the stealth bomber or stealth fighter pilot? And in the movie he answers, I don't know.
Yeah, he says it in a very thoughtful way. He says, I don't know why we fight, you know, and he knows that there are people who disagree, and he knows that there are people who agree, and he says that's part of democracy. And in his eyes, what he's doing is out there to be the sort of strong arm of the foreign policy of a democracy. And in a way, that's a very understandable position. It's not his fault that back in Washington, there are forces that are making the thing he's risking his life for hollow and corrupt. And it shouldn't be the case. It should be the case that if force is needed, and if there are people who are going to man the weapons, that the thing they're fighting for should be reliable for them. It should be believable and trustable for them.
Well, and they should know clearly what it is. And it's disturbing to me to see people who drop bombs and kill kids, which these guys did drop bombs and kill kids in their attempted strike, decapitation strike on Saddam Hussein, saying, you know, that's just really not interesting to me. It's none of my business why we fight. That's for other people to decide and tell me later.
Well, to be fair, I don't think he says that. I mean, I think that everybody has their job, you know, and all of us are taught at a certain age that, you know, to respect authority figures, and the people in the military really pledge to respect authority figures. And sure, in military circles today, and I have a deep regard for people who I've worked with in the military on this film and who I've shown it to, there is a thought going on in the military at a very high level, which is there a duty which it is the soldier's duty, an obligation to, I'm sorry, is there an order which it is the soldier's duty to disobey? And the answer is yes. And military circles have long spent time trying to understand how to think about the ethics of what kind of an order is worth obeying. And the military thinks about this far more deeply than people give them credit for. Those pilots are very deep thinkers about it. And the last they checked, they signed on to carry out policies which they tell themselves, and they could be right. They were told by the neocons that if they dropped a bomb on a certain target in Baghdad, that people would come out and dance in the streets, and you would save an incredible potential loss of life by taking the life of one man. And in their eyes, because they are people who've signed on to be soldiers for a living, they see that as fighting on the side of the angels. And people may not agree with them, but it doesn't matter. That's how they view it, and I can tell you they believe in that view. And it makes it all the more tragic when their belief in that is compromised by the fact that the people who told them that would happen didn't have sufficient information to give that advice. The people who told them that it happened had secrets they weren't telling the pilots or the public. The war itself was built on false premises. So many falsehoods debase and degrade those pilots' commitment to their duty.
Yeah, as Scott Ritter pointed out to me when I interviewed him, Dick Cheney went before the veterans of foreign wars and gave the lie again that Hussein Kamel, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, had verified that they had weapons of mass destruction, when in fact all that man had verified was that he personally had overseen the destruction of every last bit of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of contempt that shows for the people actually risking their lives, you know, a hall full of old men who fought in World War II and whose grandsons are all fighting in Iraq right now or were on their way.
It shows contempt for the soldiers, and it shows contempt for democracy.
And what they're doing here, the program, is basically the new domino theory, only this time, instead of America containing communism and stopping the spread, we're the Reds, and we're the ones operating on the theory that we can remake the whole Middle East with a little violence here, a little violence there. As the pilot says in the documentary, I was told that if I drop this bomb and get this target tonight, that the war might be over tomorrow.
Right.
Well, here we are 3 years later. We see how completely false that was.
Yes, a lot of false promises are given to these people in order to get them to do something against their better judgment. And in fact, that's why I'm very inspired by the public, because in a weird way, through the lives of the powerful, I see the spirit of the public. And what do I mean by that? When the powerful tell us lies to get us to go to war, the extent of the lies shows you that they're trying to get us to go to war against our better judgment. It underscores that our better judgment as a people is not to go to war. And so I trust that the public understands that, and that the peoples of this world, look at the marches before the war in Iraq. 30 million people around the world marched against this war before a single shot was fired in anger.
Yep.
If you compare that to the analogous year before the Vietnam War, 1963, about 13 Quakers marched down Fifth Avenue in New York City, and nobody hurt them at all. That's an incredible development in 40 years of collective consciousness around the world. The peoples of this earth understand that their lives are interconnected, and that what's going on among the powerful is an outmoded way of doing business. And it's just that the powerful have the weapons, and they still have a tremendous amount of authority and power, but so did the dinosaurs. And they dug in their heels, too, and then the ice came. So I don't think this is going to last for long, and I think the public can see that, and the public is ultimately the force that drives society. We have seen that throughout the chapters of human history. Louis XIV certainly never thought that the public would rise up and cut off his head. And I can tell you that revolutions throughout history always look like they wouldn't happen until suddenly they're upon us. And I think if you trust the public, you will see that the public will take control of those parts of their society that are faulty and that are broken and that are in need of repair, and the public can be trusted to move us forward.
I hope that's true. It's one of the things that Eisenhower talked about in his farewell speech was the spiritual nature of the country being commandeered by this military-industrial complex.
Yes, he did. And he also talked about the need for an alert and knowledgeable citizenry to compel the proper meshing of this huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. Incredible words.
Right.
And what he's talking about is our national condition today and the need for the public to be the force that compels it back towards some kind of sanity.
And now when he gave that speech in 1961, obviously, you know, a lot of people took note, but really there hasn't really been a period in American history where, since then, where these men have really been thwarted. The military-industrial complex has just gained an increasing amount of control over our society, Ike's warnings completely notwithstanding.
Well, people who advocate the military-industrial complex and they don't like the criticisms of it will tell you that during the Clinton years there was a soft patch and the numbers slipped back a bit and they slipped more. And they'll also tell you that we spend less of a smaller percent of our GDP today on the military than we did back then. All of those are illusory arguments. They betray the fact that over the years there's no question. If you look at, for example, the portion of our federal discretionary budget that we spend on defense, we spend more on defense than on all other parts of the discretionary federal budget combined. And that is what Congress decides on, and they decide to do it more often for the military than on everything else.
Are you sure about those numbers?
Yeah.
The entire budget's $2.5 trillion a year, right?
No, that's not the discretionary budget. That's the federal budget. The discretionary federal budget is the part that Congress decides on that isn't just built in.
I see.
And of the discretionary federal budget, we spend more on defense than all other parts combined.
Right. And, you know, of course,
not just a semantic figure. That is a huge figure. Currently, we spend about $750 billion in this country on defense. And you have to understand, how do we get to that number? Because we're used to hearing numbers in the 400 billions. Well, that does not include soldier benefits. That does not include our nuclear program. That does not include a little thing called the war in Iraq. That does not include a little thing called the war in Afghanistan. Those are all individual appropriations. When you add all that up, you end up at around $700 billion.
Right, right. Yeah, the wars, I almost just said war singular. The wars and all those other expenses, as you say, those are not included in the military budget.
The number we
always
hear thrown around,
right,
the 400 billion. That's a base number.
Right, absolutely. And what we're really talking about here, if we can go ahead and break this down, what we're talking about here is welfare for people who are already millionaires. That's what we're talking about.
You know, but I don't single out people. It's welfare for a system that is hooked on militarism because it's so lucrative and it's got the politicians in its pocket. And I think we've got to stop pointing fingers at people and point our fingers at the system, because the system is a part of our evolution as a country. You talked earlier about how we broke off from an empire and we were a republic. we were. And something has happened over a couple hundred years where we are becoming an empire. We are huge in the world. We have 860 U.S. military bases in 130 foreign countries today. To combine that with our economic influence, our political influence, and our cultural influence in those countries, we are a colossus unprecedented in human history. And so we've got to look at ourselves and say, okay, empire is here. What do we do about it? What are the challenges of it? And can we reconcile the realities of an empire with our dreams for a republic? And is there a way to keep our republican ideals in check and keep them respected while also flirting with these giant aspirations around the world? And the point is that Washington warned us that empire was a danger to republican liberties. Eisenhower said that empires require this kind of military permanent preparedness, and that the danger of that is that you can erode the very thing you're trying to defend. All of these issues face us, and we've got to just look at today and say, okay, that's the wisdom from the past. Today is a different time, but is it so different that we're about to throw out everything we hold dear in order to try to keep control of this world in an imperial fashion? And I think if you ask everyday Americans, do they want to be a republic or do they want to be an empire? And if it's possible, which one do they want to steer towards? You're going to hear people say republic more of the time.
Right. And the real problem is the question is never put to them, do you want it to be this way or that way? Because you can't have it both ways. It's one or the other.
Right.
But the question's never asked to be answered.
That's this national crisis we have of extremity on television, people shouting at each other. Nobody takes positions that are mixed. You hear, every time I hear, even you, when I hear you say something about the Soviet Union, or I hear you say this or that, we've got to get away from simplifying these things. We get caught up, and we're so bummed out by the way that TV is simplifying everything that it can lead you to simplify yourself. You say, well, that's so wrong, I'm going to tell you this thing. And the reality is we've got to start to disarm from this standoff that's evolved in this country where everybody just says tit for tat. Well, the reality is it's always in between that. You know, it's never as simple as people want it to be. And I'm not trying to make it complicated so people's eyes glaze over, but the reality is if you start on a premise that's simplistic and wrong, you end up looking for weapons of mass destruction in a country full of people who don't like you. You know, you've got to look at the textured story of any place and any time.
Although, are you concerned that sometimes you look over simple things that, you know, in the search for such complicated answers that you miss the easy ones? I noticed that in nearly 2 hours I didn't hear the word Israel once in your movie about America's war in the Middle East. That's kind of surprising, don't you think?
Well, I know, and I've had people say that to me, and I think, you know, I say this as a Jewish person whose father fled Nazi Germany, and I'm very sensitive about issues that relate to America's involvement with Israel, and I certainly recognize that, for example, a number of the neoconservative thinkers that were behind this administration in implementing the war in Iraq were also deeply involved in advising the Likud party, the very hawkish Likud party in Israel, in their conduct against the people of Palestine. And I think that there is a movie to be made about that, and I would actually be comfortable making it myself, and I think that I would do justice to the subject. But I didn't think I could do justice to that very complex and very large subject in the context of a movie that's about many wars going back in time and not just about the current war. And the particular inclinations we have in supporting Israel in their in the posture toward the people of Palestine is a condition that I think is highly controversial. I have my own feelings about it, and others have opposite feelings. And I thought that would have sidetracked a movie where I was really trying to get at forces that have been true of all our wars, not just the current.
Well, in the movie, you have Chalmers Johnson talking about the importance of oil, not just to our domestic economy, but to our war machine itself. It's this perpetuating thing. We have this gigantic military that needs all this fuel to run on, and so from their eyes, they're not going to leave it to the risk of the free market to see whether foreigners will sell it to them. They must, quote-unquote, secure that oil with military power, they think.
Yeah, it's kind of a catch-22 in that regard. People forget that not only are we out for petroleum for our own kind of national life and maintaining that privilege against the rise of foreign adversaries, but that we're also concerned that if we do have the rise of foreign adversaries, we compound that with the need for oil to run those machines of war. And so the military itself has an interest in seeing a petroleum war conducted, because after all, that's the lifeblood of their machine.
Right, and it's funny that these so-called conservative capitalists don't believe in capitalism, because if they did, they would know that Oil is a liquid, and it's a fungible resource, and it's always going to be for sale. And even if Iraq started selling all their oil to Russia, then that just means that Russia will have more to sell to Europe. In that case, Venezuela will be selling less to Europe and more to us, or whatever it is. It all flows around equally anyway.
What you're noting is just inconsistencies, convenient inconsistencies in how policymakers say one thing on a given day when it's convenient, another thing on another day when it's convenient. And I think the public notices that, and Americans hate inconsistency. And so that's one of the reasons I think you see such a drop in approval ratings for this war and this particular administration, because they saw too many whiffle waffles. What they call them in the election? Flip-flopping.
Yeah.
And when the people see flip-flopping in their leaders, as John Kerry learned too well, and as George Bush is now learning with the drop in his ratings, the American people don't like flip-flopping. They want to hear an answer, and they want it to be a true answer. And they don't want to know that Monday's answer is different than Tuesday's.
Right. Now, do you think that the war in Iraq, I guess this sort of goes back to what I was talking about earlier, about it sort of seemed to me like a big part of the establishment, not so much the arms manufacturers, but maybe the older establishment, was really not so much against the Iraq war, but they definitely didn't see it as their project. It was sort of a side project for over a long-term imperial agenda. We see even, for example, General William Odom, who was the head of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, giving speeches talking about how the Iraq war is bad for the American empire, which he loves and supports and thinks is great, but that this Iraq war is a big strategic disaster, and it's made the maintenance of the rest of our empire more difficult.
Yes, that's all accurate. Somebody in an interview said to me, you know, if you had to be blunt about it, you'd have to say that Bill Clinton was a better imperialist than George Bush, and that's absolutely true, because Bill Clinton understood the role of soft power, diplomacy, of our cultural values, of our friends and allies, in maintaining the incredible American footprint in the world. And what George Bush has done by allowing advisors, perhaps his own inclinations, to guide him into so rash an action is that he's frightened the world. He's frightened away our friends. He's made it hard for American businesses to conduct themselves in foreign countries. He's made it unsafe. And he's also made such an overcommitment of our troops in one part of the world that our security presence, so necessary for maintaining the imperial grip elsewhere, is shrinking. And, of course, what do you need? You need more men. But, unfortunately, the depravity that went on in leading us to war has caused the recruitment numbers to spiral downward. And so now we don't have the more men we would need to man those ramparts all around the empire. So, yes, he's done a great disservice to America's imperial project while thinking he and his friends were doing a service to it.
Well, I guess there's a silver lining on every cloud, huh?
Well, it's only a silver lining in some sort of small Washington poetic justice. For the rest of us, it's a tragedy. It's a deep tragedy for the Iraqi people, and it's mostly, after all, a tragedy for the hopes for global democracy, because America carries the torch of global democracy, and when it's undermined here, you can argue it will soon be undermined everywhere. And George Bush's disregard for American democracy and his disregard for the democracy of the community of nations represented in the efforts of the United Nations sets an example that is just going to be frightening in the years to come to see other people. Are other countries going to torture Americans when they're captured overseas? Are other countries going to manipulate intelligence to conduct a war against the United States? Are other countries going to hold our citizens captive and not give them basic rights provided for in the Geneva Conventions? George Bush has put Americans in danger, he has put America's hopes in peril, and he has imperiled the very hopes of global democracy.
Well, I'm confused about the hopes for global democracy. Didn't you just describe how global democracy was just the great euphemism for American empire under somebody like Bill Clinton?
Not at all, because it's again what you were asking for before. You seem to equate democracy with democracy derailed. Democracy, when it's functioning, and democracy as we idealize it, and republic as we idealize it, is government by the people, of the people, and for the people.
Well, it's
and
government by the majority for them.
Well, no. I mean, what you're looking at is it depends. I mean, the reality is that people try to find a way to govern themselves as opposed to being governed by tyrants. And in that, they decide to have one man, one vote. And that is the basis of democracy and republic as it was set up in our Constitution. And the trouble is, even in the beginning from our Constitution, we had black people were only 3/5 of a man. Women weren't given the right to vote. And so this society has been trying throughout its time to improve upon that and to find a way to really create a set of standards that we can define as democracy of our ideals, something we can really invest in and feel good about. And the reality is that when we see it undermined by a leader who lies to the public, who deceives Congress, who plays with the instruments of power and violates the checks and balances, that's when you have a real threat to democracy. And then I wouldn't equate that with democracy. You could say, well, democracy, what good is it if it's so vulnerable to attack? I would argue with you that capitalism is attacking democracy, that Americans have stopped being able to discriminate between what is capitalism and what is democracy. And democracy needs to be kept pure. It needs to be protected from the forces of special interests. And when that doesn't happen, yes, you end up with a kind of a skeleton of democracy that's been chewed apart by the dogs of corporatism. That's what we're experiencing. But don't lose your hope in democracy itself. Democracy itself is an idea, and the point is, what's its implementation? And when the implementation is corrupted and poisoned by forces in our midst, then my job is to stand up and protect those forces, because I do believe that democracy, if it can be correctly carried out, is something worth shooting for everybody. I do believe in that, absolutely. I don't believe it's worth dropping from a B-2 bomber onto another country. I don't think you can force democracy. Democracy has to come from within. The same way that the rebels who broke off from Britain were seeking some democratic ideas about their lives, and they fought and died for it. I think we all have to be willing to do that from within. But I don't think you can spread democracy. So what you stopped me about a minute ago was the idea of spreading global democracy. That's very, very different than the tradition of global democracy. The tradition of global democracy has never included the word spread.
Well, but
very big confusion.
I guess I don't know what global democracy is if
well, it began
the
in Athens,
General Assembly at the United
tradition.
Nations?
No, it began in Athens, and it's an old tradition. Democracy is an old concept, which we are a very late bloomer in. We're a tiny little country, a blip in the history of man.
I see, but you're not trying to imply, you're not trying to promote the idea of a global democratic government. You're just talking about democracy where it exists around the world in separate places.
Yes. Absolutely. Not one world government or something like that. We're talking about the tradition of global democracy, basically the global tradition of democracy.
Sure.
The tradition throughout the world and throughout history of peoples seeking democracy, not the idea of spreading it at the point of a gun.
Right.
That's not democracy. That's a forced form of something. I don't even know what it is.
Well, you know, and I'm glad we clarified that, and I hope that doesn't sound too kooky to you, but there are, you know, many people who say that the way, many people with power, in fact, many liberal internationalists who say that the way to prevent wars like we have now is to give that war power away to an even bigger power, even further away, that will hopefully limit our ability to use it all the time, which to me is a big mistake.
Right.
If you want to have self-government, you have to keep it close to you, not far away.
And I think I agree with you, and I think what those people are recommending is inconsistent with our founding ideals. It's inconsistent with the ideas of Republican government. It's incompatible. You'd have to really change the Constitution radically to make that compatible.
Right. Yeah, I really do appreciate that. And, you know, Chuck Lewis's thing at the end of your movie there, where he talks about this battle between democracy and capitalism. And I like Chuck Lewis. I've interviewed him before, and he's a great guy. But to me, it sort of seems like a misnomer. What we're really dealing with is, well, again, this complex, the combination between the two. And what we have is capitalism using democracy.
Exactly.
And destroying it, when what we need to do is keep these things separate. It's not, the problem isn't that we have free markets. The problem is how they're not free and how government intervenes on behalf of their favorites in the market all the time. That's
exactly
what this military-industrial complex
is. I think we'd all love to see a free market. I think we'd all love to see it. And instead, what we see is corporatism, cronyism, allowing certain forces to be more powerful than others. What did George Orwell say? Certain are more equal than others.
Right.
And what happens is that erodes the very heart of the trust we need in a democracy of one man, one vote. Because I ask you, if I call my congressman, or the head of Lockheed Martin calls my congressman, whose call is he going to take?
Lockheed's, of course. And this goes to the nature of the empire, too, and how you mentioned before how most Americans have so much trouble even recognizing that the U.S. is an empire. And it's because a lot of our imperial nature is not U.S. Marines raising Fallujah to the ground in most places on Earth, but is in fact men with briefcases coming and saying, look, you're going to take these loans, we're going to pay you off, we're going to put your country in debt, and then we're going to take all your resources for ourselves. And they call that spreading free markets as they do it.
Exactly.
So we see, like in South America particularly, the socialists are doing great in every election because they see American imperialism calling itself capitalism.
Right. Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's a real danger, and I think that any good capitalist has to understand. And that's why you've seen a number of defections from some of the richest people in the world, like Bill Gates, like George Soros, like Warren Buffett, who disagree with the policy. And they see that what's happening is that sort of the dogs are being let loose, and they're being let loose without any leashes, without any regulation. And that favors the very powerful. And the history, particularly the history in the effort to create democracy in the world and to promote democracy in the world by societies of themselves, has been a struggle to protect the weak from the strong, to make it so that people who have an early advantage don't just get to form a sort of a faction that oppresses everybody else.
Eugene Jarecki, he's the director, producer of the brand new movie, documentary film, Why We Fight. It opens nationwide February the 10th. The website is sonyclassics.com/whywefight, or you can go to my website, thestressblog.com. And
by the way, it's even easier. People can literally just go to whywefight.com.
Oh, is it whywefight.com?
Yep.
It'll forward there.
You can go right there. That's okay. Fast.
Great. All right. It was an excellent movie and excellent interview, too. Thank you very much
for your time,
sir.
Thank you a million for having me.
All right. Take care.